Henry Ponsonby noted in his diary for May 1867 that the Queen had taken John Brown along for the opening of the Royal Albert Hall. He deprecated rumours that the people lining the route had received the Queen with only half-hearted applause. He also wondered why so much notice was taken of Brown, and observed, "John Brown, dressed in Stuart tartan and kilt, followed in the procession with the servants, and was much taken notice of. Indeed, there was an almost audible murmur of John Brown when he appeared. Why he should not have been there as much as the sergeant footman with whom he walked, there is no reason. Yet it certainly created bad feeling." Ponsonby was used to seeing the Scottish gamekeeper everywhere. The crowd, who had recently been reading the rumours about Brown's unconventional friendship with the Queen and seeing him caricatured in journals, was not. The Brown scandal, which came to be fairly common knowledge in London society, was a titillating contrast to the dull but correct story of the Queen as loving wife and mother of nine children. As a query to the Queen, Henry Ponsonby's main duties had to do with companionship and facilitating transport. The first major trip the Queen made after the death of Prince Albert was in August 1868 to visit Switzerland. Although the going out and coming back required extensive consultation between a query and special couriers, once they arrived, it was Brown who looked after most of the Queen's needs. He forbade her from keeping hours different from those she kept at home. So she often did not drive out from her rented villa until 4 in the afternoon. The Queen relied on what the household could tell her of their day trips at dinner and on Henry Ponsonby's light touch to relieve the gloom of Brown's diktats and decrees. The fact that he was on good terms with Brown was a recommendation to the Queen when it came time to choose a new private secretary. The Queen was truly at a loss after Albert's death in 1861. The emotional loss, of course, came first, but Albert had also organised all her dealings with the government, as well as the management of her money, freeing her up to give her energies to the birth of nine children. No small job. With her husband gone, she appointed his private secretary, Charles Grey, who was also Mary Ponsonby's uncle, as her own. When Grey died of a stroke in 1870, the Queen promptly appointed Henry to replace him. There seems to be no question in her mind of anyone but Ponsonby taking his place. Ponsonby's appointment as private secretary, with Sir Thomas Biddulph acting as keeper of the Privy Purse, was the occasion for a new memorandum setting out precisely what the Queen expected them to do. Both Sir Thomas and Colonel Ponsonby should keep watch on what goes on in and out of Parliament. This is of the utmost importance, for the Queen has little time to watch everything and is sadly overworked and is so often unwell now as to require much help. In the present day, when the old traditions are being more and more lost, the Queen feels it is of the utmost importance that the greatest watchfulness should be exercised. The trouble was that by 1870, the Queen was less interested in what was going on inside or outside Parliament, despite her protestations to the contrary. The line about old traditions being more and more lost was the homily of a lady beginning to feel her age. At the beginning of his first term in 1868, William Gladstone made one of his most quoted pronouncements: "To speak in rude terms, the Queen is invisible." More than any other Prime Minister in the 19th century, he insisted that the proper role of the monarchy was to be visible and to be respectable. The sovereign's political role was wholly dependent on the royal families sustaining their popularity by pleasing people and being seen. Gladstone believed that Prince Albert and the Queen had set a high tone in society by espousing sobriety and hard work. They had built up tremendous popular support. However, as Ponsonby wrote to his wife, Gladstone had told him that the Queen had laid up in early years an immense fund of loyalty, but she is now living on her capital. Ponsonby followed Gladstone in deploring the fact that the Queen did not keep up what he called her show duties. The Queen had such a horror of being seen that she could sometimes be invisible even to members of her own household. If Ponsonby wanted to see her, he had to send a note via a footman or Brown or one of the ladies in waiting. Often he did not see her for days at a time, and they carried on their business in notes that went back and forth in the red leather dispatch boxes. After the death of Prince Albert, she saw as few people as possible. Not until 1865 did she reappear before the assembled household and allow the band to play after dinner. All of them considered this a huge step forward. Mary suggested to Henry that it was a pity the Queen did not see more people, and particularly refused to see the sort of intellectual company Mary most enjoyed. She rued the fact that the Queen preferred speaking to the wife of one of the gamekeepers at Balmoral, Mrs. Grant, to the wife of the historian of ancient Greece, Mrs. Grote. Henry agreed, though he teased his wife by pointing out it was easier to speak to the gamekeeper's wife, who talked about scones, than to speak to Mrs. Grote, who might raise the question of women training to be doctors. The Queen had learnt to avoid controversial topics, and even among the household would start calling the name of her dog, sitting under the table, Tumby, Tumby, when someone at dinner raised a subject too near the politics of the day. Very quickly, Ponsonby came face to face with the frustrations of his position. He enjoyed the contact with Gladstone and the confidence the Prime Minister placed in him, but any illusions he may have had about taking part in political negotiations were largely shattered. Even when he tried to advise on a small matter concerning the mixing up of the privy purse and the household accounts, the Queen had civilly but firmly told him that he knew nothing about it. There were so many difficulties in giving the Queen advice, in approaching her on topics where they might possibly disagree, that sometimes it was safer not to give any at all. Henry did develop clever dodges to get round this. He would write the draft of a letter to a minister, both with what the Queen wanted to see and with his own views on what ought to be said, lightly crossed out. Then he would submit the draft to her for approval. Sometimes she would decide the crossed-out language was better than what she had originally wanted. Or he would find a seemingly offhand way of returning in conversation to a first refusal from the Queen. For example, when the Queen asked who might represent her at the funeral of the Empress of Russia in 1880, he reported to Mary, "I said, Prince Albert." The Queen said, "No, of course he couldn't." I said, "Of course." But as I did not know why, I got back to him in the course of the conversation and said it was a pity he couldn't. So she telegraphed to ask him, and he said he would. So, sometimes, Ponsonby got his way with the Queen through a combination of system and indirection. From 1874, the Tory Prime Minister, Benjamin Disraeli, revived in the Queen a love of her office. His sense of showmanship and his talent for exaggeration were the secrets of his success. Anything less likely to impress a woman who made plainness a religion and who liked nothing better than a wet picnic in the company of not very talkative gamekeepers is hard to imagine, and yet it worked. Disraeli spoke to her as if he really did believe in her wisdom, sagacity, and power to do whatever she wanted, and it made her more interested in politics than she had been since her husband's death. The Tory Prime Minister quickly became a favourite. When the Eastern question, the renewal of instability in the Crimea arose, the Queen was as appalled by Turkish atrocities as anyone. It was a mark of how much Disraeli had renewed her interest in politics that she actively discussed this at the dinner table in 1876. Now she took up politics with relish. It was one of Ponsonby's principles to manage the Queen by speaking to her plainly. So he boldly struck out and supported the Liberal opposition when they attacked Disraeli for his pro-Turkish policy. The Queen, however, had long had a horror of disagreement. When she was first married to Albert, she refused to have political conversations with him. She felt that it was difficult to preserve her dignity and be disagreed with at the same time, even by her husband. She had always had strong likes and dislikes of the people who served her. When they were high in her favour, Brown and Disraeli could do no wrong. Anyone who suggested otherwise must be disloyal to her. So, Ponsonby's mild but frank protests about Disraeli's handling of the Eastern question upset her deeply. She decided to work round him. He remained her private secretary, but she made sure that others did the work. She carried on her correspondence direct with Disraeli, rarely showing it to Henry. So he felt he was entirely in the dark. He gleaned what he could from the newspapers. He was really angry in his letters to his wife, preferring to be tickled or amused, even by the humiliations in his work for the Queen. But in the late 1870s, he was clearly upset at being muzzled by her on politics, and depressed at the prospect of more work for her when, in fact, she was doing everything possible to avoid him. In 1878, Ponsonby's colleague, the keeper of the Privy Purse, Sir Thomas Biddulph, died. The Queen considered making an openly partisan move, indicating how out of favour Ponsonby was and how incautious she was becoming under Disraeli's influence. She approached the Prime Minister's private secretary, Montagu Corrie, and asked him whether he would consider joining her staff. She thought of making Corrie her private secretary now and moving Ponsonby over to Biddulph's place as Privy Purse. In the end, Corrie refused to leave Disraeli, and Ponsonby hinted that he would prefer to resign rather than exchange the private secretary's place for that of Privy Purse. A different solution was arrived at. Ponsonby became both private secretary and Privy Purse. The episode ended in a sort of endorsement of Ponsonby's standing and authority within the household, while on political topics, he and the Queen continued, at best, to agree to disagree.
Tomorrow, with her husband away attending the Queen, Mary embarks on a few projects of her own. Geoffrey Palmer was reading Henry and Mary Ponsonby, Life at the Court of Queen Victoria by William M. Coon. The producer is Elizabeth Allard.